information, where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
So, what is the Holy Grail, folks? What is it? Is it supposed to be the cup used by Jesus at the Last Supper and to catch his blood from the wound on the cross? And what's that got to do with divine feminine? And what's heretical in it? You may ask. Why did searching for the Holy Grail become the goal of the medieval knights of legend? Let's consider the story of Parsifal. Do you all know the story of Parsifal? Anybody not know the story?
I don't think I do.
Okay. I will summarise it briefly since most people know it. It was an ancient legend, probably first written down as an epic poem in the 13th century by Wolfram von Eschenbach, which is such a great name, I have to say. Parsifal, as a young boy, leaves home to become a knight. His naivety and innocence turn to courage and strength as he travels far and wide, overcoming danger, amassing great riches and glory. One day, as he falls asleep, exhausted from his latest conquest, he experiences a vision in which he enters a glittering castle and meets a wounded king, sometimes known as the Fisher King, whose wound is in the thigh. Traditionally, we're told a metaphor for the genitals, so you could say this is a cycle of sexual wounding, we might say today. The king tells Parsifal that the land is a wasteland, dying through neglect. There is in the castle also a beautiful maiden who holds out to him the most precious prize of all, the Holy Grail. In this picture, it's the Christian version of the cup. But in older versions of this fable, it's a stone with magical powers left on earth by angels or fallen down from heaven. Parsifal stands speechless, not knowing what to do, and the vision fades. And when he awakens from his trance, he feels strangely desolate and vows to find the mysterious castle again. Only after many years of trial and tribulation can he find it again, but he does find it. And now he has the maturity and the wisdom to see beyond the glitter and to contemplate the deeper meaning of the Grail. Instead of trying to work out what he should do with it, the masculine doing, he looks within himself and asks how best he can serve such divine beauty. Now the story ends with his becoming the custodian of the Holy Grail, an honour that deeply humbles him. And in the end comes the realisation that he is the king's son. The maiden is to be his wife, and the castle is his inheritance. In accepting these gifts, he reawakens to his rightful role. The king's wound is healed, and the wasteland is restored to its bounteousness. What has this to do with us, you may ask? I hope by the end you will see. So we've been beginning to talk about Christianity. Andy asked if there are any fundamentalists or Christians in here. Probably not, I'm guessing. Whether you consider yourself to be a Christian or not, isn't it true to say our whole culture is informed and based upon Christianity and it influences our psyches in many ways? And there are many millions today who are Christians whose lives are dominated by its dogmas and teachings.
Bank holidays to contend with, if nothing else.
Okay. So let's consider these direct or indirect influences on us today. The Christian Church celebrates Jesus as a celibate masculine God figure. It honours Mother Mary for her virginity, although this is not specified in the Bible, but was probably just inferred from a mistranslation of maiden. It's still heresy to suggest that Mary did not die a virgin, even though she was married to Joseph and there are siblings of Jesus mentioned in the Bible. The Pope and all Catholic priests must be male and celibate, and that's been so since the 12th century. The Church has us all down as original sinners, and women in particular, as an embodiment of sin and general wrongness. Among women, only his virgin mother made the grade. Bit of a hard act to follow, isn't it? What has this done to us? Seriously, our psyches, our relationships, our sexuality.
And as for terrified of it.
Exactly. And if we accept that all of this, as for the other Mary, she was just a prostitute, wasn't she? If we accept that all of this Christian stuff is important And might it then be important to examine the identity of the other Mary more closely? So you all know the Da Vinci Code, yes? Anybody not know the Da Vinci Code? You don't know anything about the Da Vinci Code?
Heard about it, not read it.
Okay, well, it doesn't matter. Dan Brown wrote it, and his research is based on the work of Margaret Starbird, the once staunch Catholic matriarch, now turned heretic and champion of Mary Magdalene. Starbird, in her four books on... I recommend them, I'm not selling them tonight, these are my copies, but I just showed them to you if you want to have a look at them, they're here. In her four books on Mary Magdalene, she is clearly prone to speculation, but for me this does not undermine the scholarly and robust nature of her research, and I credit the second part of this talk to her with most of this information. She writes about this painting that you can see. This is a picture of a woman sitting on the steps in front of a door that is closed. Lying around her are the remnants of her mantle. The picture is by Botticelli and is called Derelicta, which means the abandoned one. When I first encountered this painting, she writes, it seemed to me to be an illustration of a passage in the Song of Songs. Do you all know what the Song of Songs is? Mm. Also known as, it's known as the Song of Solomon in the Protestant Bible. In this passage, the guardians of the walls attacked the bride as she was seeking her bridegroom in the streets of the city. They set upon her, stripped her of her mantle, which is a metaphor for rain, and beat her and then told her to go home. I was amazed when I started to read the explanations that art critics had offered for this painting. They tried to pin it on various Old Testament women who were mistreated, but none of them could guess who it was, who was the abandoned one. Any ideas? So who was Mary Magdalene?
Yeah.
Who was Mary Magdalene? If that was she, we'll see as we go on whether you think that was her or not. Was she a repentant sinner? Was she a reformed prostitute? There's not much in the Bible to go on, really. What we do know from it is that she had expensive ointment in her jar for anointing, nard or spikenard. We know that she anointed Jesus on the Mount of Olives, washed his feet with her hair, with her tears, and dried them with her hair. And that she, of all people, was the one weeping at the mouth of the tomb when he was resurrected, and she was the first to see him and be charged by him to go and tell the others. Does this make her significant? Let's learn more. Here we see her as often depicted naked and clad only in her long red hair. Remember Carly? Probably, I think not a lot of people know that the Vatican has officially admitted that there is no evidence anywhere to support her being a prostitute.
It's recounted by the Catholic Church in 1969, quietly on the sixth page of the news.
Quietly, exactly. Yeah. It's not been trumpeted about the place, you know, she's still basically written off, isn't she? So let me explain a little more about the Song of Songs for those who don't know about it. The Canticle of Canticles is also called the Song of Solomon. From the Hebrew Bible, it is in the Old Testament of both Protestant and Catholic versions of the Bible. It's astonishing. The protagonists of the Song of Songs are a woman and a man. And the poem, it's a poem, it's beautiful. It suggests movement from courtship to consummation. And despite seeming to me not at all religious, in the conventional sense, Rabbi Akiva, one of the founders of the traditional Judaism, he declared in the first century, so a couple of thousand years ago, he said, "Heaven forbid that any man ever dispute that the Song of Songs is holy, for the whole world is not worth the day on which the Song of Songs was given to Israel. For the Song of Songs is the holy of holies." Interesting. Interesting. But if our theme tonight of sacred union is really the holy of holies, that it is right under the noses of the Vatican in the Bible all the time.
Absolutely.
A little quote from it. "Thou hast ravished my heart, my sister, my spouse. Thou hast ravished my heart with one of thine eyes, with one chain of thy neck. How fair is thy love, my sister, my spouse. How much better is thy love than wine, and the smell of thine ointments than all spices." It's very passionate.
Thanks for me.
Now, my understanding that when it says my sister, it means not possessed in the current sense that we were thinking, but more an equal partner, someone who shares my life. briefly, the Gnostic Gospels, you probably all know about them. Yeah, anybody not know what the Gnostic Gospels are? You all know.
Not really.
Not really. Okay. In a cave, some were discovered
Dead
in the 19th
scrolls.
Century. Mm-hmm. So, the Dead Sea Scrolls are different, I'm not sure what the connection is, but these are the Gnostic Gospels anyway.
Okay.
Some of them were found in Nag Hammadi in Egypt in 1943. Mm. They've been there since 400 AD. Mm. Hidden in an earthenware jar due to the heretical nature of what they contained. They contained early Christian teachings, considered Gnostic in character, which I'll explain in a moment. In other words, these texts contained Gospels that had escaped censorship or revision by the Church, and they posed a theological threat, meaning that the people who, you know, they hid them to save their lives. That's how dangerous this stuff was. Now, Gnostic means, from the Greek gnosis, means knowledge. Gnostic, what we call Gnostic thought, insisted upon direct and personal first-hand religious or mystical experience with deity, with God, and vehemently rejected dogmas, creeds, and unnecessary intervention by clerics between you and God. Not necessarily. This was a very unwelcome stance for the Vatican, as you can imagine. Now, some of this material may have been more closely actually associated with people who lived and worked with Jesus than the Gospels that made it into the Bible. Who knows? And one of them is actually named the Gospel of Mary. In it, we find this interesting quote. Peter said to Mary, "Sister, we know that the Saviour loved you more than the rest of women." And there are other quotes indicating general jealousy among the disciples, especially Peter, and how much Jesus loved her, how he privately confided in her, even describing him as kissing her on the mouth. Is it possible that Mary had a much more powerful role than the Bible or the Vatican would like to allow? I used to think it was just modern-day wishful thinking, that the theory that Yeshua and Mary were married. But it actually is a far from unreasonable supposition, I'm told, at a time when it was simply not done for a man of his culture to remain unmarried. It just, that would have been totally wrong and weird to them. But perhaps you're thinking, well, so what anyway? What if he was or wasn't married? What relevance is it to us now? You know, that was then.
Deep psychological relevance.
Which
people need to address.
I agree. Absolutely.
He couldn't tell which culture he was by the time he finished travelling around to there.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. There's a strong tradition, especially in the south of France, that a few years after the crucifixion, Mary Magdalene was brought there by boat by Joseph of Arimathea. And some legends say that she had her daughter Sarah with her, the daughter of Yeshua and Mary. Joseph had rescued them from the certainty of being put to death had they remained in Israel, first by fleeing with them to Egypt and thence to Europe. And there, the legend goes, she lived on in the Pyrenees, carrying on the work of Christ, teaching and healing and raising their child, giving rise to an area where the feminine was honoured for centuries, and the traditions of Gnosticism in the people lived on, particularly the Cathars, who would in the 13th century be wiped out by the Inquisition for this very reason. So you start to think, well, there's no smoke without fire, you know?
There's a lot of smoke.
There are meant to be many churches there.
Sorry.
There are meant to be
many
chapels,
many churches,
with, with statues.
Yes, and Paul's dedicated to Magdalene.
Yes.
This legend specifically states that in AD 42 they were brought ashore at this little French fishing village, Les Saintes-Marie de la Mer, St. Mary's of the Sea, which is a sweet name, where they have an annual celebration of the event, where they dance in the streets with their cherished black Madonna, and crying out, Viva Saint Marie and Viva Saint Sarah. You know, what are they talking about? Where did that come from? Interesting, isn't it? We're in the realms of myth and legend, I admit, and there is no proof, but what if it really did happen this way? What if the Gnostics, those in the know, had to go deep underground to protect themselves from violent persecution? Were there really groups of initiates? I find this fascinating. Groups of initiates who kept themselves so secret, but kept the knowledge alive through the centuries, literally down the centuries, and they're still around, apparently. Only now emerging, as you know, this knowledge is emerging now and becoming public knowledge at last, but it hasn't been allowed to be public for so long. And I'm not talking about the Holy Grail being an actual physical bloodline. That's what the Da Vinci Code is all about. Many people do. They call it the Sangreal, the royal blood. And I think that way lies, even if there are actual physical descendants of Mary and Jesus, you know, so what? That's material. That's the danger of elitism and racial superiority and that kind of thing. You know, as you were saying, I think this is about the effect on our consciousness. It's a spiritual effect and psychological effect. So, it is interesting to see how the Cathars were wiped out and how these heretical beliefs did flourish in the south of France. The Albigensian heresy, it was named after the Provence town of Albi, culminating here at this massacre at Monségur, a horrible event. Cathari means the pure ones. And with this kind of frenzied persecution, it is no surprise, is it, that anything remotely resembling heresy, that Jesus was married, that he had a child, that he had a wife who was powerful in her own right, this had to become utterly hidden. It was a matter of life and death. But why were these things so ruthlessly stamped out? What were they so afraid of? And whatever the reason, hidden the forbidden knowledge was, as we shall see in symbols, in numbers, in sacred geometry, in art and architecture. And the crop circle, Jessica. Do you all know what gematria is? Gematria is...
geometry.
It's a bit like numerology. It's the interpretation of scriptures by the substitution of numbers for letters. I can't believe the system, to be right. It was a favourite method of medieval Kabbalists to derive insights into sacred writings or new interpretations of the text. So gematria shows us that the Greek spelling of the Magdalene corresponds exactly to the number 153. The number 153 in the ancient world, the Pythagoreans worked out the actual proportions of the vesica, specifically the fish shape, you know, the divine feminine shape in the middle, was 153. So Margaret Starlow finds this incredibly exciting that Magdalene is kind of right on the money for the number of the divine feminine itself. Her name is also equated to PHI, or the golden mean. You all know about the golden section, I'm sure, from the crop circles that have the Fibonacci spirals in them. I'm sure you know the proportion of this number. It's a proportion used in art, architecture, and throughout nature. The growth pattern of plants, and this is the spiral of the Nautilus, which reminded me of the knot of banana, which is why I included it. The spiral of DNA. Your fingers, the human body, everything has got the golden mean in it. So, pentacle. Also, another elegant expression, apparently, of PHI. I'm not mathematical enough to understand why, but it is popularly connected with ideal beauty, and the Pythagoreans considered that it expressed truths about the hidden nature of existence. So, as we were talking about earlier, the hidden nature of sacred geometry behind everything. But all we know these days, it's best known for, in Western consciousness, witchcraft and the occult, or that the church considers satanic and demonic.
The pentagon at the centre.
It's also the symbol of four or five of the world's largest armies, isn't it?
Yeah.
The Yangs, the Russians, the Chinese, the Koreans, the Iraqis, they all use it. I wonder why.
That could be because they will mark their soldiers for ritualistic sacrifice with this. Generally, that's what it is. It's the guy with the puppets at the top, the puppet masters at the top, mark you for ritual sacrifice in that way to their gods. And when they orchestrate wars, then obviously that's what they're doing. Is ritualistic sacrifice for the thousands to their gods, and that is why they're marked up like that.
Right.
Well, the pentacle was apparently sacred to the Knights Templar, which I hadn't known, appearing on their gravestones at Tomar in Portugal, their one-time headquarters. Were they light or dark? The rapid rise and eclipse of this vast and certainly powerful this chivalric order of the Knights of the Temple is considered by Starbird to be linked to the Grail heresy. She thinks that their lady was Mary Magdalene. She points out that they often came from the noble families of Provence, and it's thought that they were behind the flowering of the amazing Gothic cathedrals, particularly also dedicated to Our Lady, ostensibly Mother Mary, but perhaps the other Mary. They were formed in the first decades of the 12th century, enjoying the favour of popes and kings, as I'm sure you all know, until annihilated on charges of heresy almost 200 years later, although some of them apparently escaped and became the Illuminati, according to some. Yes. But perhaps, you know, if it's true that they were champions of Mary Magdalene, that's why the Illuminati may be ruling a league then.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that they then, you know, became one of them, part of them.
It's also possible that they took it, they were getting a bit too powerful in the banking system and the banks didn't like it.
Definitely very powerful. Mm. So I just wanted to point out that, you know, the Gothic architecture that sprang from this time, the top half of the mandala is in the Gothic arch, so that when you enter the church, you are actually entering the room of the Divine Father.
Absolutely.
Do you think the church fathers realised this? Maybe not.
Some of them must. That's exactly, this was my question about the Queen. This was it. This is the crux of my issue. That was what I was getting at. Do you think that they must know?
They
some
must
of them,
know.
A lot of them must know.
Does she get much time to spend on the internet? Does she get her internet time on these?
It's not about the internet. It's about her roots.
Yeah.
It's about what she's brought up with as a child, and what's it drilled into her as a global elitist. That's what I'm talking about. They know. They know what they're doing.
They do.
I would like to hear to speak. Sorry. If you don't mind. I think you said a lot. It's very interesting, but. I'm not here to speak. Okay.
The Black Madonna at Chartres, this is. Some say the hemisphere of stars behind her represents the vault of heaven, and that the radiant, this is interesting, the radiant object above her head and the seven red lights, which to me red lights are all about the goddess. I hear that, you know, if you see a red light burning in a church, it's a church that there's someone there who's aware of the goddess. However, this person says that this is iconography of the dark star, Nibiru, as we mentioned earlier. But we need a whole other evening to go into that, don't we? But I just thought it was interesting to point out the actual Chartres of Black Madonna. Mm-hmm. Back to mermaids. This is a medieval stone carving here showing her with a little mirror. Mermaids are often sort of seem to have become the goddess of love, like Hathor with her mirror. The Lord and Lady of the Fishes below is, this is a horrid drawing in pencil done by Margaret Starbird of a painted panel, mid-13th century in Alsace-Lorraine. You can't find a picture of this on the internet, sadly, so we've only got Margaret's drawing to go by. But it's very interesting. Apparently it was covered over with a wall, because it's very heretical. It was plastered over, which is why it probably survived. Now, the partnership of the fishes was an early emblem of Christianity, as we've mentioned earlier. Now, this male fish, she's drawn into it like Jesus because it was painted into it like Jesus. Who's she? The square and the circle represent the marriage of irreconcilable opposites again in geometry. The square representing earth or matter, so the feminine is in that. Circle, heaven, spirit, masculine. And more on mermaids later, but I just wanted to point out that this iconography of the female reminds me of the Shulam Gig, yes, very explicit. Sexual connotations. So I just wonder if Starbucks realised we don't have on her logo and what the significance is of her two fishtails. Also, please note the three pentacles again.
Is it the way they set up two companies to put the other ones out of business?
Yeah. Also, some people have pointed out that you get the double M here. So the fishtail makes one M. And then another M on her crown, so she's got two lots of double M's.
McDonald's. Take them out.
Is this conscious, or is it bubbling up from the collective unconscious? Just a brief skim through roses will really be long line. The rose is one of the most well-known symbols of the divine feminine. You can overlay the pentacle over the wild rose. Venus, the transit of Venus, makes the pentacle. The rosary, note the name, when laid out flat, makes the feminine symbol, which in turn resembles the Egyptian Ankh, gate of life, key of life. The rose window, this is the Chartres Cathedral, the mandala of sacred geometry. The spiral labyrinth, also from Chartres, with a six-petaled rose in the middle. Labyrinth designs are found all over the world, as I'm sure you know, dating back at least 4,000 years.
Where's that one from?
Chartres. Chartres. Yeah. Chartres Cathedral is packed.
Where's that?
don't know exactly where Chartres, northern France, somewhere.
France, yes. About, yeah, half, yeah,
halfway,
yeah,
halfway down,
down somewhere.
Halfway,
yeah,
down Chartres. Chartres.
I vaguely remember driving through.
4 hours drive from here.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you. The tarot, very briefly, from which have evolved our modern playing cards, were branded heretical officially by the Inquisition around the 13th century, about the same time they were busy massacring the Cathars. Some say the tarot once told the entire Grail heresy story, but that the original meanings became lost over time and generalised, probably because of the danger. This card, traditionally entitled the Empress, the Major Arcana card, portrays the energy of the Great Mother, you could say, although during the time of the Inquisition she would be depicted as whichever queen was on the throne at the time for safety. She is often depicted wearing the headdress with the disc and the cow horns, again, Isis and Hathor, the ancient Egyptian headdress, or in this case the woman from the Book of Revelation, crowned with 12 stars. Starbird's latest book is all about the tarot, apparently, if you want to go more into that. So, Da Vinci, the Last Supper. Where's the Grail cup then on the table?
There is no cup.
There's no cup on the table.
I've seen the movie.
It's here. It's here. There's a little animation there for you. Very cool. Don't think the painting actually does do that. So what was Da Vinci saying? He was saying that it wasn't material, that it wasn't a cup. It was something that's up in the air above their head, something spiritual. And what was this all about? The famously controversial figure on Jesus' right hand, traditionally known as St. John? Come on. Many now claim this is Mary Magdalene. I'm one. St. Peter, holding his hand over her throat chakra, sort of karate position. Symbolically, Peter, the rock of the traditional church. Silencing the feminine? Maybe?
You just the like, intellect and the soul like. Sometimes. They say the intellect warring with the soul, and that during his 9 months in the pit before he got crucified upside down, that he kind of, they made their peace. The intellect and the soul, there was a torturous process, they do make their peace and rebirth together somehow. So that's what I've heard.
Mm.
Yeah.
Thank you. Mary Magdalene, we'll look at a few paintings of her. Here she is depicted wearing the girdle of Isis, or Tiat, an Egyptian symbol. Her jar, as we shall see in the following pictures, containing the sacred nard with which she anointed Christ. Now think about it, it's strange when a woman, roughly equating in value to a cow in those days, and when touching a man in public is under the strictest taboo, that she is reputed to have anointed Christ. The act of anointing was symbolic in the ancient goddess tradition, symbolic of the high priestess bestowing kingship, a metaphor for Hieros Gamos itself. What does it suggest about her real power and her real identity? This anointing, all the paintings show her, actually, except this one, with a jar. The jar is absolutely inseparable from Mary. This is called Christ in the House of Martha by Tintoretto, late 16th century, beautiful Venetian painting. Laden with sexual symbolism, according to Margaret Starbird. Now, do you think she's just got an overactive imagination, or can you see any of this? She says that their robes make a cross, a matching cross. This blue is the same colour as her top of his robe. And this rose colour, I think this rose colour match, so they make a cross. She says, if you see how far apart her knees are and the position of her hand, she says this is a traditional sexual imitation position, and that's exactly where he's looking. And she says, furthermore, that his hands are making the vesica piscis.
Yeah.
I put a picture of hands making the vesica piscis at the top there for you to compare. I find it quite difficult to see what he's actually doing, but he seems to be doing something very specific. I think I'd need to see the original to really have a good look, so that's on my list of things to do. Roger van der Weyden, 15th century painting called Magdalene Reading. Now, what is a streetwalker doing reading? No, she wouldn't have known how to read. This is an erudite, initiated, you know, high-born lady. So the artist painted her in very specific ways, really nothing to do with the biblical interpretation or the Orthodox Church interpretation. And she's wearing a green robe, which is a symbol of fertility. Here is her little jar. And under here we have gold robes. You probably can't tell from the side, but these are golden, shiny robes pointing out. Now, like Kali, every symbol has a meaning. You know, these paintings were not random. Everything meant something. Now, gold robes mean royal bride. They mean your bride specifically. Same artist, another painting. It's in the jar there. Starbird says that this lacing on the bodice was not normal. This was a pregnancy dress, specifically, to be extended and expandable. These are pomegranates here. Pomegranates specifically meant fertility. And most interestingly, there's this red crisscross. Now, the artist could say, well, that's just the pattern on her dress, almost, if the Inquisition came around. But apparently red X's meant, was a secret esoteric symbol of the heretical church itself, the anti-establishment symbol for truth. And I think there's a very good reason that X-rated has come to mean what it does today. Yeah. Dangerously explicit sexual content. I love these paintings. These are Georges de la Tour, early 17th century French artist. The penitent Magdalene on the left and the Magdalene with the smoking flame on the right. In both cases, she's clearly pregnant. She is wearing the white of purity and the red of passion, two of the triple goddess colours. The third is blue for the crone. So this is the colours of the maiden and the mother. I'd like you to remember the one on the right because we're going to see it again in a minute. How are we doing for time?
We've got about 7 minutes left.
Oh, hell.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, goddess, we'll have to talk afterwards in the pub. If you want to talk afterwards. Briefly, look at alchemy. We have an image of antique men of science labouring to transform base metal into gold. Was this a blind or a facade to mislead the uninitiated? Because by examining a little more deeply, we see that alchemy truly is about the transformation of consciousness itself, from its base or animal nature to a more highly evolved or illumined level. The natural person was called lead, and the transformed spiritual being was called gold. As gold is tried in fire, so the human being is purified in the crucible of life. Now this is fascinating. Jung's final works and writings of his life focus on alchemy. His last book that he produced was entitled Mysterium Cognitionis, okay? This volume focused on the archetype otherwise known as the alchemical or sacred marriage between Sol the Sun King, Luna the Moon Queen. This marriage is often referred to as the Hieros Gamos, or union of opposites. Jung studied the alchemical writings of the Rosarium Philosophorum, which defines the sacred marriage archetype. And it also defines the product of the sacred marriage, most importantly of all, which is the child of Sol and Luna. This is the archetype of the alchemical hermaphrodite, or the divine child, or the divine androgyne. Again, remember back to Lilith and how he started, beginning of creation. The result of the sacred marriage between the Sun King and the Moon Queen is the divine androgyne, the oneness that we seek. Very briefly, the heretical knowledge was also stored in fairy tales because the stories of the lost princess could be told at every mother's knee unchecked by the censorship of the orthodoxy, because the stories of women and children were not considered by the patriarchy to be worthy or important enough to be dangerous. So there we have Cinderella, an obvious metaphor for the relegated woman waiting for her prince. Sleeping Beauty, often named Briar Rose, an obvious metaphor for the feminine, slumbering in our unconscious until the time.
Yeah.
Now look at Ariel. Okay, you all know the Disney film Little Mermaid? I'm getting towards the end, the last few slides now, but I would like to read this quote in full from Margaret Starbird because it's worth hearing. What happened to the goddess, she says, of the ancient world, she who was queen of heaven and earth? She has been systematically devalued and made diminutive, relegated into the watery depths of our unconscious. And what about Ariel, the youngest, the littlest mermaid? What was her desire? Why to walk upon the green earth, out in the sunlight? It's interesting to note that in the Disney film, it's not Ariel who needs to be saved, but rather the handsome prince who is in trouble, shipwrecked and dying. Is this the condition of the patriarchy at the dawn of Aquarius? It's Ariel who is his redeemer, not the other way around. Among her treasures at the bottom of the sea is a painting. You see the painting? By Georges de Latour, called Magdalene with a Smoking Flame. Of all the possible pictures to put, it is incredibly significant that the directors of the Disney film put Mary Magdalene.
I had no idea they'd done that. That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing? For it is she, says Starbird, who represents the lost bride and the archetype of the sacred feminine. In this connection, it is almost uncanny that the little mermaid is called Ariel, for Ariel is a synonym for Jerusalem, the holy city besieged. Either the use of these symbols was deliberate on the part of the directors of the film, or it rose spontaneously from the depths of their unconscious. Okay, my concluding very few slides. So, this is an astonishing image. This is in a Christian church on the Isle of Mull. Somebody commissioned this, no one knows who, at the beginning of the 20th century, an extraordinary, heretical stained glass window. A pregnant Mary Magdalene holding Jesus' right hand in her right hand, a symbol of marriage. The quote at their feet leaves no doubt as to who she is. It's the quote from the bit about the house, Martha's house. Is this image expressing the archetype of the way forward for humanity, a paradigm of partnership for the new millennium? Is the Grail heresy then this continuum of secret knowledge, knowledge that had to be preserved from the deadly patriarchal regime that would torture and kill those that they deemed heretics? The perennial wisdom that has been kept alive by a carefully hidden priesthood of initiates for millennia, including those who nurtured Jesus and Mary Magdalene themselves. Is the Holy Grail then the mystical marriage, the alchemy of mind and heart, the perfect balance of masculine and feminine within each one of us? To find it, do we need to remember and embrace the Sophia, the lost and rejected holy wisdom, the divine feminine? And if so, how does this fit in with the current times, 2012, the long-promised golden age, the great shift in consciousness, even as some suggest, ascension of planet Earth and humanity into the light of higher dimensions? Have there been messages and clues in the crop circles of recent years? We often get divine feminine symbology, don't we? Goddess, this is the Venus, this is the Mayan symbol for Venus, the Lamect, and the Genesis flower again. Well, I just have two quotes to finish with. This one is from Matthew Ward. Does anyone read the channelings of Matthew Ward?
Mm. No?
This is a rather lovely quote on ascension. He's someone who's passed on, who tells us all about what's going on at the moment for us. Take it, you know, how you are. Once again, I tell you, he says, Earth's ascension out of the vestiges of darkness is assured. Each of you is responsible for your own journey. You are on the right pathway when you know that you are a part of God, that your soul is eternal, and that there is no separation of you from God or any other soul in the universe. When you listen to the voice of your soul, by heeding your conscience and trusting your intuition, when you respect all life forms as God's creations, when you know that love is the most powerful energy in the universe, when you live from your heart. So are we ready now to live from the heart? Embrace the divine feminine and enact the sacred marriage within each one of us to birth the divine child of Christ consciousness. Remember the story of Parsifal. Does that story now make sense in the context of what I've been telling you? It's the story of the great quest of mankind along the spiral path to reconnect with our true inheritance, the divine reunion with ourselves. Could finish with a poem if we had time. Mm. Yeah? This is a beautiful poem called No Longer Derelicta by a lady called Noor, who is of the initiate of the Order of Mary Magdalene. Excuse me, I'm getting hoarse. I am going home to my beloved, where I will no longer be the derelicta. I am returning to my place as the glorious and magnificent bride. I will be heaven on high, for I am going to be with my King. Blessed am I who holds the rose and sits at the left hand of her Lord. Blessed am I who holds the wisdom of the universe, who walks the way in light. Blessed they will call me as they bow before me and weep at my feet. They shall welcome me at gates of gold with roses and garlands and crowns. And there shall be doves, pure and white, singing sweetly. And my beloved shall welcome me home.
going to do questions, but we haven't really got time for questions. But I do want to say just two things. A, thank you. That's very enlightening. And no, I don't think everybody did know all of that. So thank you for sharing that very much. I forgot at the beginning to say, Barry Winnie, run an organisation called, well, that's not quite the right word, organisation, but a thing called Merlin's Diary. And it's very good. If you want to know anything about this kind of stuff that might be going on somewhere in, first of all, your part of this country, but now moving out to other countries, I understand, you can just put information up about any event up on Merlin's Diary. So wherever you live, you think, hey, is there anything on this week of this ilk? Go to Merlin's Diary, and there it will be, and you'll find out what's going on. And it does work, because I gave a talk the other day, and put it on Merlin's Diary, and at least one person said, oh, sorry, on Merlin's Diary about an hour ago, I had no idea at all. So there we go. It's easy to use. If anybody organises events, or you know the events you want to put up there, go on to Merlin's Diary. I don't think you have to do anything other than just register and
very quick.
Just upload your stuff.
It's free.
They're doing a wonderful service. Yeah. I mean, Barry and Winnie also run an organisation in Forest Row. And you have lots of meetings, you've got your own little room in the village hall there. Always interesting stuff going on. So talk to Winnie and Barry anyway. Have you got a mailing list or anything?
Yeah, I've got a mailing list if anyone wants to know.
Go and find out. So there's always interesting things going on. So well done for doing that. Merlin's Diary, has been a real asset, so, and is set to grow.
It's like the eBay or Amazon for My Body Spirit fans.
Indeed.
Well, can we come and get protection notification of this store? Your email address.
Yeah, if you leave an email address, then we'll send out notes for you, anyone who's interested.
Yeah, have a chat with Barry and Winnie at the end. So thank you so much.
Merlin's Diary, there's some cards here for that on the table. If you want
yes, so there we go. Yes, you can take a card in and find out all about it. So, that's it for the summer. We're back in September, 22nd of September, and we'll be looking, maybe, at the crop circles of the year, or talking about why there aren't any crop circles of the year. And then in November, which sort of dovetails from summer where you've been coming from, in November the 17th, we've got a guy called Jess Hughes, who's great. He's a modern shaman. If you're into shamanic stuff, and you want to hear how that dovetails and what's going on in the world now, come, November the 17th, that's really going to be worth hearing about, basically modern shamanism, what does it mean to you, and more than you think, actually, and he's very good. So, come on to that. So thank you for being here. If I could ask two things, A, if you could just stack some chairs before you go out, and just neatly put them up. Thank you to Marcus and John, by the way, for turning up early to help today, as I'm obviously a bit impaired. Thank you, Barry, for your help. And most of all, please, another big round of applause for Winnie. Thank you. That's it, and we'll probably be in the pub.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.